Well, we are beginning session 7, Social Empower and the Economy, under suboptimal conditions because our video conferencing connection to the seminar in Argentina seems not to be working for some mysterious reason today. Therefore, it's especially important that we record our discussion of this week's material so that our good friends in Buenos Aires will be able to listen to it by logging onto the web for this. So hello, comrades in Buenos Aires. And sorry that you're not part of the dialogue
and
today.
Bolivia.
And well, the Bolivian group will listen to it anyway on the through this medium. So today, like last week, the discussion revolves around three different proposals: the equal asset market socialism, social economy, and unconditional basic income. There are a whole variety of other proposals that will be in this chapter. This is one of the incomplete chapters where I ran out of time to provide the details for additional examples, but I didn't feel, the reason I left it as a gap was that I didn't feel there was any kind of intellectual problem in filling it out, whereas for some of the other chapters I still had substantively difficult things to work through, so I left these in the to-be-written stage. The one that I wish in a way I had included, that I had written it out, because I think it would be especially interesting for our discussion today, was the Wikipedia example, which is such a distinctive case and provides a nice sort of eye-opening counterpart to a lot of these discussions. The thing, just to make a little comment about this, the thing about Wikipedia, there's many things that are quite astounding about it, but one way to think about what's astounding about it is that if you went back 15 years ago, before the internet really took off, so 15 years ago the internet was just in its infancy, its potentials were not understood. It was a quite limited basis for sharing information. So 15 years ago, somebody had said, you know, my prediction is that within 15 years there will be an information, consolidated information encyclopedia on the internet with upwards to 3 million topics covered, edited by several hundred thousand people around the world, in a completely decentralized and democratic way, available free to anybody on the planet who can get access to the internet in a public library or other facility, and that all of the contributions of people will be unpaid for, people just do it voluntarily, and that the quality for most of the entries, not for all, but for most, will be comparable to other standard reference works. So if somebody had said that, they would have been thought to be completely out of their minds, that this would have been so far outside of the realm of possibility, and on so many different dimensions. How could you get serious people to actually, without being paid, contribute and edit these things? How could you possibly assure reliability? I mean, won't this just be not just uneven, but completely unreliable? You know, there'd be endless arguments against it. And those arguments would all have been very reasonable. So I think Wikipedia is a good example for envisioning real utopias, partially because it shows how limited is our ability to predict what becomes possible when new, in this case, technological innovations occur. But the innovations that make surprising things possible need not be technological. I think a similar thing could have been said about the participatory budget in Porto Alegre. Before it occurred, nobody would have really thought that an efficient, low-corruption or no-corruption city budget could coherently be produced by the participation of 10 or 15,000 ordinary citizens in the course of a 3 to 6 month deliberation process, and that could be done iteratively over time in a developing country. You know, the people would have thought that that also is just not the sort of thing that could happen. Now, an incorrect conclusion from the surprisingness of these things is therefore, if you let your imagination run wild and come up with completely implausible and surprising possibilities, that therefore they probably could happen, right?
So just because some things which are incredibly surprising do happen doesn't mean that everything we can concoct that seems implausible could be a future surprise that could happen. You know, so I don't mean to have the conclusion from these little poetic ruminations on my part be that anything is possible. Wikipedia wasn't in the chapter, it will be,
but it can still be a kind of background context for our discussion. Now, in this week's interrogations, there were a couple of interrogations raised especially by Ricardo and a little bit by Rudolfo as well, and then a few other people brushed up against this, which were questioning the very kind of core idea of the social empowerment and the economy framework that I was elaborating in this chapter and in earlier chapters, where I basically argue that markets in one form or another have to be part of the institutional design, that a socially empowered economy cannot be a socially empowered non-market economy. It has to have markets playing at least some role. It's not arguing that they have to be dominant, but they have to play some role. And Ricardo especially made the argument that markets and socialism are fundamentally incompatible, that markets will invariably, he was suggesting, regenerate capitalist relations. And he argued, in contrast to markets, for the possibility of comprehensive planning of a participatory and democratic character, so that his rhetorical challenge was, why is it the case that I argue for what I called recombinant decentralization, remember that bit of jargon I threw in, for the empowered participatory governance analysis of the state, why did I argue for recombinant decentralization for the state but not for the economy? And if we can have a participatory planning process in the state, why can't we have participatory planning in the economy? Now, I do think that this would be a good occasion for us to discuss that general question. What's the problem with comprehensive planning, and why are markets an essential part of any plausible democratic, egalitarian, socially empowered alternative to capitalism? But maybe we should put that to the latter part of the discussion. There's this issue of whether we should first go through the specific proposals, kind of sort them out and see how they work, and then raise these more general issues. I don't imagine that the vain hope that we'll be back online with Argentina so that they can participate in that discussion, since the strongest statement of this sort came from Ricardo. It's a shame in a way not to have him part of the discussion, although I'm sure this will come up again in one form or another in the discussions of the logics of transformation. Since I think it probably follows, it's not 100% clear to me, but it probably is true that if he is correct that there is no way of combining markets and social power, that markets will invariably corrode social power so that you'll always get back to a capitalist equilibrium. If that's true, then ruptural strategies become the only viable strategic form of transformation. Interstitial and symbiotic strategies become very implausible if you can't meld together market relations with social power. And therefore, when we get to the ruptural discussion of ruptural transformation, which will be the second week after the break, this theme will come back there as well. All right, well, why don't we... I'm also stalling a little bit to hope that Rodolfo comes back from trying to reach his Argentine comrades. But let's see, Rodolfo mostly made his interventions around the asset, I think, equal asset socialism more than the social economy. So maybe we should begin with the social economy discussion, and then turn to the equal asset market socialism discussion. Seem okay? Okay.
It's an interesting topic.
Yeah, Guillaume has a. So now what I've done here, as I did last week, is just arranged in no particular order all of the kinds of comments and themes and issues that people raised in their interrogations that were linked to the social economy issue. I don't think we necessarily need to simply move down this list. Why don't we just sort of open the floor to the discussion of the social economy and have anyone who had raised issues around it just begin by raising some of those issues, and in the course of our discussion we will, you know, meander through this list of possibilities. So who would like to jump in first on social economy themes?
Maybe in relating to the bigger question you had about, like, whether things can fit into the, like, whether you can have a social economy working within a capitalist market system. One of the things I was thinking a lot about when I think about this is how when you have something that works on the basis of a social economy, how that institution still has to react and be able to adapt to the constraints around it. And it's still essentially it relates to the all or nothing thing, whereas if you take the daycare example, if there's a shortage of daycares because there's a high demand, but there's not enough supply, then either the cost goes up or there's a shortage, but if the cost goes up, there's still not enough. If the cost goes up, that'll provide incentive to create more of those co-ops. So it's still essentially functioning with a market logic. It's just the distribution within that one entity is more just.
But I'm sorry, the cost goes up for who?
Well, if you say you have a shortage of daycare.
Right.
Then how do you solve that?
You're saying in the social, like in Quebec now.
Yeah. So you have the daycares which are run on a social economy.
Now the signal, what's the signal for a shortage?
Well, you have parents, you have waiting lists.
Waiting lists. So it's the same as in a public library. If there's a shortage of a popular book, there's a reserve list. And the list gets longer.
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't we contrast how an economic system responds to that signal, mm-hmm. if it's a capitalist market versus a social economy? Because I think that helps to reveal why not everything that has the character of at least a market-like relation, people buying and selling and providing services, they don't all have the character of a capitalist market. So what happens in a capitalist market? You know, you've got a shortage of supply. There's a waiting list for all these daycare centers. What's the likely response if that was how we were providing daycare? This is asked to anybody. Now, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you can be on the spot if you want to.
Well, I think basically you would have an increased, the profits you would get from running a daycare would increase because you could charge more money. And then as a response, you would have more daycare being offered because the incentives would be higher for people who weren't doing that to start doing that. And so it'd be a balance point which would not necessarily meet supply, but would meet wouldn't necessarily meet demand, but would meet effective demand. So mm-hmm. demand that could be paid for.
So there's two different responses which probably worth distinguishing. One is, you said that the price would go up, you'd start charging more. That could take the form of new daycare centers entering the market at higher prices and old daycare centers still charging lower prices. So that is, those people on the waiting lists who can afford to
would then opt for the $12 a day rather than a $7 a day is the
That's
curve.
How it is right
yeah,
now.
So at the moment it's guaranteed at $7 a day, but not everybody can get a place. So a capitalist firm could enter the market and do it at $15 a day. The subsidized daycare can't charge more than $7 a day. There's a law. So it's like the law that says libraries have to rent their books for free. Right? So they can't charge more, so they get a waiting list as a result. Some people on the waiting list are desperate enough that they'll pay more than $7 a day. And so they'll go and buy. So the capitalist market is to provide more supply, but probably also to stratify the market, stratify the service is another feature of the way a capitalist market would react to this. So they would develop expensive good quality daycare and cheap bad quality daycare. You get some kind of differentiated market. Yeah.
I just have a question about, is there, once they get the subsidy from the state, is there like a contract that they enter? Or, because I'm just thinking with like Section 8 housing, where it was in the advantage of a lot of landlords to take the subsidy because they were guaranteed tenants, but now because of the gentrification of a lot of neighborhoods, they were able to get much higher prices than were guaranteed by the Section 8, so as the contracts have run out, a lot of people have been displaced because no one's opting to re-sign the Section 8 contracts. So,
I don't know.
So is that something that could also happen? Is like, you know, could places that were subsidized by the state, once they realized that they could get a lot more money than those state subsidies provide?
No, you can't really do that.
Why?
Well,
I don't know how it works.
The way it works is that the parent will sign a check for $7 to the daycare, mm-hmm. and the daycare centers or the child care centers will be paid by the state, probably a monthly payment. The state will make a monthly payment to each of these daycares, and so they can't really charge more. No parent would tolerate.
Well, they could conceivably, but it doesn't happen, abandon the state system and just set themselves
right.
up as a private co-op and not get the subsidy from the state and charge $20 a day.
Well, in that case, yeah, but then they would be just a private daycare.
Right.
But if there was a shortage and they realized that they could still have enough clients that and get away with charging $20 a day, what would be...
I think they charge much more than that. I kind of did a bit of website search, mm-hmm. and what I found is that there's 205,000 children right now in daycare centers, and the private market has less than 5,000 kids. All the other are into what is called like the CPE, which is the co-op,
right?
Child care or the daycare, where it's probably there's a differentiated income strata among the daycare centers. These are also subsidized by the state for $7. And there's also like at home
right.
service where the state is also right. providing with extra subsidies.
Right. So there's not a shortage now, though, right?
There is a waiting list for those for the CPE, which is the daycare. Uh-huh. There's actually no spots available because I suppose people value that service more because it's a cooperative, and each caregiver is given probably is earning the same amount, whereas the daycares there's a stratification of wages, I suppose.
They recommend that you put your kid on the waiting list as soon as you know you're pregnant. In Quebec.
I have a question about how this works in sort of capitalist markets in, say, the United States. Because I have the impression, and I don't know this because I'm not a parent, but that there are shortages of quality daycare in many large urban areas in the United States. And it seems like the classic feminist critique of the way that child care and other forms of domestic labor are provided is that it's not a marketized service because you can exploit this sort of non-market form of labor, i.e. women's labor in the household, you can exploit that labor to provide this service outside the market. So it seems like there's at least in things like most of the things that we're talking about in terms of the social economy, so child care and elder care and things like that, there's this, capitalist markets have this sort of side door kind of possibility, which is that you get some, you sort of offload it onto people in the home or whatever. And so it's not necessarily true, is it? I mean, I'm asking that capitalist markets are in fact efficient at overcoming shortages of things like, of services of this nature, right? At least they historically haven't been. So there's a question of why.
Well, their capitalist markets are extremely good at providing daycare centers for people who can afford it.
Right.
It's just, I mean, capitalist markets have never been good at providing expensive services for people who can't afford it.
But that translates in this
expensive
context.
Anything. It doesn't provide cars for people who can't afford it.
Right, but that translates into, I mean, what appears to be from one perspective not providing something to people who can't afford it is a shortage. There's a shortage of daycare for people who, there's demand. There's not effective demand, but there's arguably demand. I mean, it gets into the sort of messy question of when does, you know.
But that's true for any, that's nothing special about childcare. That's true for every commodity that can.
Right, so, but this, that makes the question even more pressing, right, then, which is that, you know, I mean, if the assumption is about capitalist markets is that, you know, in the event of, that you can assume that demand translates into effective demand and that translates into a price signal, which will translate into greater supply. But that appears not to be the case.
No defender of capitalist markets would make that claim, that wants get turned into effective demand. So poor people want fancy cars. They want it. They demand it. I want a fancy car. There's no way that can get translated into a supply of fancy cars for poor people, because the cost of producing fancy cars makes it too expensive. So it's not a market failure in the ordinary capitalist sense. That because there is no unmet demand for fancy cars. Whenever somebody who wants a fancy car and can afford it buys one, if there's a shortage, that will stimulate the production of more fancy cars. So I think that's a generic problem of all markets where you have poor people, that their wants cannot become market demands, or their needs cannot become market demands. And that's only a criticism of, it's, of course it's a criticism of capitalist market, but it's not a criticism of the supply and demand logic of capitalist market. It's that the supply and demand logic of markets cannot provide commodities to people without money.
I mean, it is a criticism if we're talking, I mean, it's not a criticism if you're talking about fancy cars, but it is a criticism if you're talking about childcare. Something which is if you're talking about a socially necessary service, however you define socially necessary, I'm assuming we can come to agreement that childcare is.
So the Milton Friedman argument would be, the problem is that we have licensing of childcare facilities. If we got rid of all licensing, so you could have really bad childcare for poor people, then there would be a market response for them. Just like he argues, you should get rid of licensing of doctors.
Because licensing is a cost, and
restricts the entry of
the produces an artificially restricted supply
of low
and
quality.
Therefore, demand is greater than that supply, increasing prices and decreasing the amount of.
Well, and also it puts a restriction on the quality distribution. So just as we have cheap food and expensive food, and really crappy housing and expensive housing, so. Building codes also put a restriction on how bad housing can be. And the pure free market types say that's a mistake, that the poor will be better off to get lousy medical care than to get no medical care. They'll be better off with bad child care than no child care. And that if you put no restrictions on the market, then you'll have providers of really bad child care who will make affordable child care available to the poor, and the poor will... This is not a caricature. I'm not caricaturing his argument.
No.
And then Eric said,
"I really am not caricaturing."
Well, my first question is: first of all, is that a plausible theory of why there's a shortage of quality of any daycare in urban areas in the United States? The second question is: I mean, back to the feminist critique of this,
the argument is that it's not that you're not providing daycare. The argument is that you're providing daycare by offloading it off of the market onto unpaid labor in the home. I mean, isn't that the essential feminist critique? So it's, you know, the argument is that it is a form of exploitation that is accomplished by not providing something to the market. But the point of all this, though, again, is that I'm just trying to get at what are the assumptions we're making about the efficiencies of capitalist markets in satisfying social demands. And I think that saying that it's, you know, the fancy cars argument, I think maybe works for fancy cars, but I don't see how it works for childcare, because of that, it really, I mean...
No, I mean, I don't think it's central to our point, our main point about the nature of the social economy. It works as well for basic needs as it does for anything else. It's just that in the case of basic needs, there will be some defenders of the market who will say, yes, we have a problem here that needs to be solved because we have values other than market efficiency. We have a value that people shouldn't starve. We have a value that children should have good daycare. Those are values which require us. Any hope?
I will give them the number to see if they can call.
Oh, did you reach? You reached them?
Yeah, they are still there. Seems that they are drinking the wine.
So they're drinking their wine. We're drinking our wine.
Yeah, it's all going well then.
Yeah.
So probably this is something that SSC did since last week, is my guess.
Yeah, I have to check, but...
Or maybe SSC made it possible for them to call us, do you think?
I don't think so, because they tried to...
Co-ops.
do they have a Skype connection there? We could just see...
Yeah, that's what I will try if they...
And Skype is down on the bottom if you want to...
I don't see the IP
left.
For us. No, oh. Our IP...
I have no idea what our IP is.
Mm. Well, but you don't need it for Skype.
No, but for they will try on this. Okay.
So, at any rate, while poor Rudolfo is missing our brilliant discussion here because of his commitment,
we're exploiting him by offloading our technological labor.
getting back though to the main theme here, If there was a capitalist market in daycare and there were waiting lists, there'd be some attempt to provide a higher, more expensive service because you'd get some of the people off the waiting list that way. Note that public libraries actually have started charging very low rentals for books that are extremely popular so that you can get off the waiting list by renting.
Really?
Some libraries do. Yeah, the local library here has $1 a week rentals for.
And what books are on that list?
Well, it's whatever the
Billy Tobin series.
You know, they order 50 copies of some bestseller. They don't want to order 500 copies, mm-hmm. And they'd have to order 500 copies for there to be no waiting list. And so they ration partially by time and partially by charge. And that capitalist solution might or might not be successful in providing adequate daycare for everyone. But note, if you got rid of regulations, you could get rid of some regulations. You could still require that, you know, child molesters not be daycare providers. So you could regulate that. But you could say the standard daycare requires one adult for every three children. We will allow 10 children for every adult. And then you get a lot of people entering the daycare market because you can make a fair amount of money doing that. And if you got rid of the regulations, you would get enough daycare. It just would be of a less desirable quality. So it's because of a decision to interfere with the market that you can't have a full-bore capitalist response, even in the capitalist market, because you just simply prohibited certain kinds of supply, which would solve the market demand problem, because if there was no constraint on how many kids you could have it very cheap, very cheaply provided. But I want to draw the contrast between that and the nature of the mechanism for a response to an unsatisfactory supply in the social economy. So the capitalist economy will give you, capitalist markets will give you differentiated prices, perhaps. entry of new firms into the market in response to these things, maybe a reduction of regulations in order to allow for...
They will call us to see.
What about the social economy? What's the logic of the response to a growing waiting list? How would it work as a mechanism of response?
Well, you'd have to get the government to decide to subsidize more.
Right.
And you'd have to have people decide that it's worth it for them to stop what they're doing and start doing that.
So the key difference is there. There's a political mechanism that has to kick in to solve the economic problem. That is, it has to go through some kind of political process. So the expression, the government has to increase the subsidy. Now, the government wouldn't necessarily have to increase the subsidy per kid. The government could just say, our total, I assume that the reason why there's a waiting list now is that there's a budget constraint. The government says we're going to have, you know, $10 million or whatever it is for subsidies, and when you run out of that, there's no more places. There probably would be more people prepared to organize co-ops if there was more subsidy around, is my guess. But it's not the unwillingness of co-ops to form at the existing level of subsidy. It's not that they'd have to get paid more to do it. It's just there's a budget constraint on how many the government's prepared to subsidize.
But I think it's feasible to see that second problem also coming into play.
What is the second problem?
The issue of essentially, if you work for a co-op that's subsidized, your salary is determined by the government, right? So when they go on strike, they're striking against the government. And then, so essentially, the government has to increase the wage of people working in the co-ops indirectly through the subsidy in order to create more incentives for people to enter into that area. I mean, it's like the medical system, which isn't functioning on co-ops, but whose incentives to be doctors are lacking because of income. And so the same, I mean, either in one case the government has to decide to make a political decision, you know, to subsidize more daycares, or to raise the subsidy level, so it's something that people want to do.
So, and that's an empirical question, which is the bottleneck. You could imagine the bottleneck being just the number of daycare centers that the government's prepared to subsidize, but not the amount of remuneration that goes to each daycare worker. Or it could be that even if the government was prepared to subsidize twice as many daycare centers, nobody would want to do it. All the people who want to do it are doing it at this level of subsidy. So you'd need to increase the subsidies the level of the subsidy in order to get more daycare centers. But my main point is that the difference between the way a capitalist market responds and the way a social economy market responds to these things, at least this kind of social economy, is that the latter is politically mediated, that a political decision has to be made about how much of this service is going to be provided and at what rate. And that implies that there's a political process which is weighing the trade-off between more daycare and more highways and more public libraries. And that's the nature of the conversation around it.
Yeah.
Rather than that conversation being at the level of individual households saying, how much do we want to spend on our children for daycare versus our summer vacation versus our fancy car? Mm-hmm. So in the ordinary capitalist market, individuals are making these trade-offs and deciding what they want to consume and how much, and that's what's providing the signals to the providers. Whereas in this social economy realm, those kinds of decisions and trade-offs are being discussed at a political level.
How are certain issues relation to what you're talking about? How can you solve issues about diversity or more autonomy in terms of administration in a socialist economy, a social economy? Because I see that capitalists would say we can have differentiated costs for whatever we're providing, then we can add certain
diversity in the projects of commodities we're offering. It kind of justifies the reason why things have different expenses. How would you do that in this sort of more centralized or more, because of funds and because of resources, maybe more rigid offers of services?
So what do you think about diversity in the social economy? Let's do the same kind of contrast. The nature of diversity that gets provided in a capitalist market for, again, let's say daycare, just as the example we're working with, versus the kind of diversity you would get in a social economy of daycare. I'm being more Socratic than I usually, putting the question back to the...
Well, diversity in a capitalist society isn't really promoted unless it maximizes profits. So what you see in this example of daycare is the people politically saying to the state, we want a more of a value put on daycare as a necessary human service. So I'd imagine it would work in the same way, or at least there's more potential for that than in a capitalist society, because unless you can make more money by diversifying or doing things that respect diversity.
I think that's only the case if you have, there's a shortage of supply in either context. You don't have room for choice. Right? Like if there's a shortage of an essential service, you don't get to choose. You can't reject a bad provider of that service in favor of a good provider, which in the case of capitalism, you can't. Either, like, you can't reject a bad provider in favor of a provider who you can't afford.
But is that because the state that we're currently talking about is still working within a capitalist framework? So they don't have all the resources to make those decisions or to prioritize in that way?
Well, that's why I think the question you asked about whether, how well the social allocation, government allocation of funds, how relevant that is to what society wants outside of a radical, egalitarian, democratic society, how well you can achieve what you want, mm-hmm. even to the extent of social economy.
Now, I think one way of thinking about this, in part at least, is that there's different dimensions of diversity. What capitalist markets would in general be pretty good at, with constraints, is having diversity of quality. Right? So, where we have regulations which prevent the bottom end of that distribution from actually occurring, but capitalists would be happy to provide it. They just are prevented by law from providing the really low quality version of the products. But we know for lots of things, for motel accommodations, for lodging accommodations while you're traveling, the capitalist market is capable of providing really crappy and pretty inexpensive lodging, as well as incredibly expensive. So that's actually a pretty effective market for producing diversity on the dimension of quality and cost. The social economy daycare system is much more heavily regulated than that with respect to quality. I assume that while there may be the natural variation that you'll get because you'll have some wonderful teacher in some daycare center and somebody who's grumpy in another, you'll get variation, but
solely on personalities.
But it's more on the basis of idiosyncratic things. Rather than there being an actually engineered stratified system on quality. But I would bet you because of the co-op character of this, you'll get quite a lot of diversity in of a more thematic character. You'll have some daycare centers that put a lot of emphasis on music and others that have lots of outdoorsy stuff, and you'll get diverse and maybe religious, you'll have some that are oriented towards immigrant populations with a more ethnic focus, and you'll have others that are have some other. So the co-op character could generate a lot of diversity on styles and character of the...
But trying to build on your example, just thinking out loud actually, say like the music one might because of the kind of environment in which create mass. It might be the cost might be higher than one that's just providing, I don't know, just maternal kind of care. I don't know, I'm just making things up. Just saying that you might have, if you want to give that variety, that diversity, I imagine some of them be requiring a higher cost than others because of the nature of whatever service they're trying.
In the capitalists.
In the markets, I mean, even in a cooperative, just
in the social economy.
Yeah, just trying to build on his example. Like you can have certain diversity in a sort of social market economy. But still, what I'm saying is that diversity still will have different costs, I mean, natural differential costs. So how will you deal with that? I mean, what would you say is legitimate to provide this that has more cost than others? Is that just because people just will still like the ones that are cheaper or not?
Well, the costs of the parents are the same everywhere. In the Quebec case,
there's a material surcharge.
No. So, $7. That's it.
I'm almost. Well, that's funny. I just read an article about waiting lists and material surcharges.
There might be a
which
if the
$4 a week or something.
If the parents want to bring, or if the caregivers want to bring the kids out for a day in the country or anything like that.
Paper, scissors, type material surcharge.
Yeah, but the parents don't have to pay that. They're not that. There is a law actually on. There's a bylaw that says that parents don't have to get involved in any like, extracurricular activities. I mean, it might just be a question of peer pressure if
does
everybody
keep the
go.
The children out of those activities because that is.
Well, I mean, you're getting services for $7 a day. You can't.
Right, but if this child's allowed to go play games and this child has to sit with
there's a whole range of nuances around these sorts of things. So the Quebec case is trying under non-ideal conditions, that is, they're operating within a broader capitalist context, to provide something which is close to free, that is, $7 a day isn't free, but it's close, it's almost at zero cost. There are some arguments for why you want to charge something rather than make it absolutely free, in the sense of giving parents a different view about the nature of the service and their expectations and their relationship to it. I mean, I don't know if that's just rationalization or if it's true, but there may be reasons why you want to charge something so that it wasn't entirely paid for out of taxes. But in any case, it's pretty low. It used to be $5 a day initially, right? And then it was...
It's $7, and there's talk now to increase it to $8.
Yeah, so...
For people who are really... who wouldn't... Because I'm sure there are people who can't afford to pay $7 a day.
It's free.
Okay.
If you're in the very low-income strata,
okay.
It's free.
Right. And so there are disadvantages in having any means testing, because to create stratified participation... there's stigma issues and there's other problems with that. But in any case, the Quebec form is occurring under capitalist conditions. Now, if it was in a broader context where the issue of how much resources would go to this versus other things was under a fully democratic deliberation rather than a constrained democratic deliberation, then I think... the fact that some daycare centers might have higher costs because they had a different focus wouldn't necessarily be viewed as a problem. And it wouldn't necessarily be that the government subsidy to some daycare centers might be higher than to others because they had a music focus and they had to buy certain things, whereas the one without a music focus didn't. I suspect there would be provisions for that kind of variations built into the nature of the subsidy regime.
But that means that people must be really, really democratic, right? I mean, to be willing to do, to accept that kind of difference. So obviously we're going to get that with your last question, Ricardo's question. I mean, if you can actually think of these things outside the sphere of capitalism in a more social economy. I see that kind of limits in terms of how much people are willing to sacrifice certain earnings or certain privileges to kind of put a more common, like a common expectation for all. I see that probably be pretty difficult.
In terms of thinking about the provision of services and other needs through the social economy or other devices, you know, there's only so many different ways that different kinds of needs can be met. There's different institutional devices for it. So I roughly list four. Things can be done by the state. They can be done by private families for their own members. They can be done by markets, or they can be done in the social economy. Those are four different ways that you can provide. I think that there are trade-offs, that there are advantages and disadvantages for each of these, including for capitalist markets. There are advantages and disadvantages. And therefore, if we're thinking from a real utopian design question, it's really how do you combine these things so that you first of all optimize what sorts of needs provision are provided and through which sorts of institutional mechanisms, so that we do want some things to be provided within intimate relations. You know, and a standard, this may be just puritanical on my part, but sexual services one thinks of as something to be provided within intimate relations, not by the state. You know, the idea of state provides sexual.
It's really funny. I was just thinking of that earlier when you were talking about price and quality, because I can't get the fact that you can pay $4,500 for a prostitute.
Right. So you can, you know, so those, the possibilities are within the family, or meaning within intimate personal relations. In the market, well, capitalist prostitution isn't so great. The social economy, but
as if it's there.
What does that say?
No. It's a private call.
That's probably. I think that's my cell phone.
Is this your cell phone? I'm sorry.
It's all right. No. Rodolfo was using my cell phone, but I don't want to answer it during.
Sorry, I thought it was Rodolfo's.
It was Jenny. Jenny Sell is my daughter in Tucson, but I'll call her back.
Sorry, Eric.
Yeah, so, you know, some things are properly provided in the most concentrated way outside of markets and outside of states and outside of the social economy. Some things, I think, can be most effectively done within the social economy. I think child care and elder care and things like that, health care, are probably most constructively organized as social economy services. And then within that, then, there's all sorts of different institutional designs we can imagine.
No, we have the problem here, definitely. But
has Skype also dropped out?
Yeah, they don't have Skype.
Oh, they
have
don't.
Only the TV with this program, so there's no way to...
None of them have a laptop in there with Skype?
No. That's what I asked. No, I told them just to...
they will
talk about the tree and everything, and we will assume I will just leave.
Okay, so they will listen to our...
Yeah.
Recording, and so we're talking about the social economy and about what it's optimal for, what sorts of things, and so once you decide that certain kinds of services, and it could be more than just services, one could imagine certain kinds of production as well, but let's for the moment just services are easier, are best done in community-based social economy activities organized in as cooperative and democratic a way as possible, but which require for their sustainability redistribution of resources through the state. So the state both sets rules for the social economy, regulates the daycare centers and establishes standards and all that sort of thing, and provides a basic subsidy of resources for them. So that's the kind of parameters of it, but then you can imagine all sorts of additional mechanisms and variations on how you would actually organize and run things. Yeah, Charity.
Don't we also have to think about the system, the entire system? So
there's food corporations, right, who provide lunch for these daycare centers. There's, you know, people who make the, there's Crayola, there's all these materials. So when we're talking about something and using it like this as a specific example, perhaps there's an element of thinking as a total, because if you still have private companies making money off these, off of this state subsidized thing, there's a lot more that goes into that. And I don't know, and I guess it's getting to my last point on here anyway about, you know, to really make something like that socially democratic, you really have to have an entire system in place. Maybe I'm pessimistic, but...
So we should not have the program because the kids might draw with
it. I'm not going to say that.
A capitalist
Crayola. I'm not saying that. But for our purposes of looking at it as a real utopian project, that's also the things we have to be thinking about. I think every program is all-encompassing, and...
Sure. But, I mean, I don't see why these co-ops would not probably buy their food from Montreal co-ops. And it would be...
I don't know. Are they?
I didn't thought of that question, honestly.
But it's interesting when you look at the education system here. It's not run as co-ops.
Absolutely not.
But certain things become cost-dependent because there's limited budget that you're trying to do a service with. And food has been one of the things that has lost out in that negotiation. And so when your budget is essentially fixed by the state, and you have a service to provide, and you have to provide an adequate living for the people you're with, in a capitalist economy where you don't necessarily get the amount of money that you would want to get, it can cause, you either have to decide, you know, is it where the budget gets restricted in areas that you would ideally not want to restrict it. So I think that's a good...
And I think there are all sorts of problems with what you're talking about, and especially looking at education and then food provision in education, and then you start looking at like corporate influence in education and all these deals that schools make with like Snapple and Coke to only sell that, and then, I mean, there's all sorts of those problems. But I think this came up in one of the weeks before, is this, if this is like a system that we would want ultimately in our utopia, so that granted that it's, we don't live in, we live in a capitalist society, that, and that this is something that could work both within the capitalist society and, you know, whatever form of socialist economy that we would ultimately want. But I don't know, I think it does speak to the transition process, or could be a step in that direction.
Now, we've mainly talked in this discussion so far about why we might want a social economy provision of something, let's say childcare, over the market, capitalist market providing it. But there's another alternative, which is the state directly providing it. You know, just having state-run daycare centers where the state has employees and hires them, and those centers could be run with some kind of council. They don't have to be run in a completely authoritarian command and control centralized way, although state-run schools and daycare centers tend to be a bit hierarchical, but that's not a necessary feature of it being state-run. So then the question is, what's the advantage of a co-op sector over just state-run daycare centers?
That's interesting. I was just thinking about if we were to look at schools and how schools are run, because, I mean, and I don't know how the funding here works for schools, but essentially you have a school board that has a lot of leeway over how the funding they have is spent within the school, and they still have standards. And the funding comes from the government, I think?
It's local property taxes here, mostly, but it's not entirely. So.
And so it's sort of interesting to do the same, I think, exercise we did looking at the economy, or daycare under capitalism, under market and co-op, or looking at school boards under government and co-op, but essentially what the differences would be, because we can essentially consider school boards to be locally run here with certain standards of education. And they don't have, I think sort of we would hope that co-ops allow for different diversity of daycare options to be offered by the fact that it's not one person deciding everything. But I don't think the education system has panned out that way, where you have a lot of diversity in the different education systems, like recognizing that there's a structure that education systems have to follow. There's still not a lot of diversity between different school boards, I think.
And there are proposals. The United States is a kind of a leader in this, for better or worse. to have things like charter schools and vouchers systems for schooling, which essentially provide for public funding, like the child care co-ops, but allow all sorts of heterogeneous ways by which the schools actually get organized, where the state, the public school system doesn't hire teachers any longer. The teachers get hired by whatever entity forms a charter school, which could be all sorts of entities. And they're still licensed. There's some kind of limited regulation. But you could imagine public education being organized as a social economy rather than as a state enterprise. Mm. In the American context, it's mostly the right wing that wants to move in that direction because they see it as more market-like. And they see it... Some see it just as more market-like. Some see it as a step towards privatization of public education. So vouchers and charter schools are kind of intermediate forms that move more towards the market rather than forms that move more towards deep democratic participation.
But if it's under market forms, even though it has this sort of notion of social economy, I think you say it actually in your article, like it's so easy to see people trying to make a difference in terms of service they do in it by trying to increase the service they're giving, so they make, they attract obviously the kind of people they want, even though obviously you can think in a comparative of people belonging to a neighborhood or to an area, so you have like natural bondage between people. Say we want a school that responds to our, but still you would kind of see difference within that population too. So you will kind of feel people trying to build it in a certain particular way. So what I want to say is that under a market, even if it's a social market model, still probably end up with some form of competition, some form of stratification, some kind of form of concentration of resources and so on, and even profits. So how would you solve that? Just through regulations, and you do that, then what would be the difference of having just a state-run?
Well, you can have competition without profits in the sense that profits means that you have money left over after your expenses, and that goes to what are called the residual claimants, whoever owns the enterprise. So I don't think that... I presume that in the Quebec case, there may be a little bit of competition among daycare centers. That is, they're trying to attract parents and kids, and some do a better job than others, so there may be a little bit of competition. But the incentives to compete against other centers are pretty weak compared to the incentives to just do a good job taking care of the kids. So I assume it's not very intense competition. You know,
it seems to me that the only reason why there would be competition is because the cooperative board members has to be constituted of 2/3 of camp users. So as opposed to the other subsidized daycares where only, I think, 5 parents have to be part of the board members. The difference is if you belong to the co-op, the parent is not, it's not only the kid that is using the co-op, it's the parent as well that is able to have an input over the educational curriculum. That would be the only form of competition that would exist between daycare providers.
So there are what I would call social economy proposals for schooling, public schools, which take the form of fairly radical versions of vouchers, school vouchers. Sam Bowles and Herb Gintis in their book Recasting Egalitarianism, have a proposal for reorganizing public schools. I just aspirated a wasabi pea. So for the historical record of this recording on our website...
Talk amongst yourselves.
At this moment in our deliberations, the person who's talking too much has aspirated a pee.
That's a furball.
A few more wasabi peas.
Those ones.
It's a danger to be. Maybe I need wine rather than water to.
You can
give me a little.
Give me some wine first.
No.
I think. No. So, in the Bowles and Gintis model, I may never recover from this. No more wasabi peas. The wasabi peas need to go somewhere else on this table. I think dry, oh, that's not dry. Dry, flaky things are things I should avoid while I'm talking. So the Bowles-Gintis proposal for schools runs basically like this. Any group in a community can form a school. There will be buildings available. So there's some relatively weakly specified physical infrastructure. But, you know, you can imagine all sorts of solutions to that problem. I don't think that's fundamental to this issue. Any group of parents, would-be teachers, community associations can form a school. They attract students by saying how the curriculum is organized, what their emphasis is, what the central spirit of the school would be. The students who enroll in the school bring with them a per capita amount of funding provided by taxpayers. So the funding for the school comes entirely from taxpayers. No topping up is allowed, so you're not allowed to charge any tuition on top of it. But the funding per student is sufficiently generous to actually provide real funding for the school. You then can specify certain kinds of rules for the formation of schools and for these vouchers based on certain system-wide objectives you might have. So, for example, you might want to avoid... schools engaging in cherry-picking, some school trying to attract all the really best students by various devices where they would have testing to get in, for example. So you could say you can't do that. You could prohibit certain kinds of admission criteria. If you want to have diversity in all schools, you could say the value of a voucher to a school is a function of the existing demography of the school. So if you have a all-white school, you get twice as much per non-white kid who you recruit as if you have an all-minority school, in which case you get twice as much for every white kid. So you can have various formulas which create incentives for schools to have diversity. So you can see how you can... There's all sorts of things you can do so that it's not just a free-for-all, it's not just a market in which you say anything goes, you could put restrictions. But still, you would get a lot of diversity in the kinds of schooling that you'd end up with. And it would no longer have the character that public schools classically have had, which is giving all kids a pretty similar kind of experience, subject to quality differences because of the injustices of the system. That's a separate matter. But that's a failure even within the principles of the system. The principle of a public education has always been it's a shared experience that all kids have, of going through a curriculum of the same sort with the same kind of schools. Well, this would be much more nichified and community-based. And the question then is, would we actually prefer a voucher-based social economy schooling over conventional public education with strong parent-teacher councils? You know, so you can imagine a public education system that we try to democratize, try to increase the voice of parents within it. Which would be the optimal from a democratic egalitarian view? Is the provision of this service best done through a public system that's deeply democratized or through a social economy system which is sort of more flexible and more community-based and more market-like in certain respects?
How would either of the different systems affect labor and teacher livelihoods, and how you evaluated teaching and ensured a good quality of teaching, but also ensured a adequate salary for teachers?
I mean, in principle, both the social economy system and a straight public system could have exactly the same wages for teachers. There's no, in both cases, they're paid for by taxes. In both cases, it's a state-funded system. In both cases, there's licensing rules that the state would impose. So in principle, there wouldn't be any reason why a social economy teaching corps or a public school teaching corps would have different rules. In practice, I suspect that because of the heterogeneity of the schools that would be formed under a social economy form, the teachers involved are likely to be less solidaristic. It's just likely to end up, the equilibrium is likely to end up with a weaker union than in a public system, where the homogeneity of the experience of teachers also tends to build a commonality of interests. So you'll have teachers in a charter school who are passionately involved in that school and who would absolutely refuse to go on strike because of their moral commitment to the building of this school. Because of the character of the work would make them not want to undermine it, and therefore that would weaken their potential solidarity with teachers and other schools that might be less well run.
Or there would just be less collaboration between schools, or just movement of teachers, because I think in a lot of large systems, teachers move from school to school fairly frequently, so that obviously wouldn't happen.
But on the other hand, it could. I think there's open-ended scenarios here. You could also imagine a community-based system of school cooperatives, where teachers and parents and other associations form these schools, in which there is then a network of these co-ops. So there's a kind of movement of movements where there's a lot of sharing of best practices and a lot of movement back and forth and certain kinds of events which different schools will come together. And you could imagine that as well. Mm-hmm. I think I'm over my wasabi tea attack.
I just said that to inform anyone who happens to be listening on the web in case they were worried about my well-being.
It seems like the things like childcare and healthcare and education, there's an initial issue that we really care about the quality of the service provided in addition to the way it's provided in the organization of the provision, that we don't care about the quality of, you know, steel, I-beams, or, you know, whatever, any other commodity.
We do if they're collapsing.
but we don't care as sort of imminent and as an important way about the actual, I mean, obviously we want quality commodities to be produced, right? But this is a much, we're talking about the actual reproduction of society, right? And so, to some extent, it seems to be a question of, well, which one actually is more, you know, which one actually works better? I mean, which produces better educational outcomes or better socialized children or whatever, which is not something you can necessarily know in advance, but it seems like if there is, I mean, if to the extent that there's a difference in outcomes, that matters more in this case than it would matter in some other commodity to which we're above a certain baseline of buildings not falling down. We don't necessarily want to prioritize quality in the same sort of way.
But I think our ideology can, or what we expect from an education system, helps answer that question. Because if you want everyone in the country to be able to engage in the same debates, you need a minimum of the same education system. As in agreeing on what science is or is not would be a good example. Well, no, I mean, and I think that...
That's a whole other can of worms.
Well, no, but I think it's a really, I mean, regardless of what, like, you think of that debate, it's a really interesting example because it's a... You can allow parents to decide what their kids will learn, which is a really empowering thing, really important. Because there's been, like, the opposite extreme has been the education of Native Americans and Native Canadians, which has not allowed for any intergenerational contact and has been most, like, the extreme of undemocratic. And so I think it is a, you know, to the extreme of things that, you know, everyone in this room does not agree with, the fact that evolution should not be taught.
This isn't a real dystopia, I think.
But how do you decide what is acceptable cultural education, what's not, and to what extent education should be uniform so that the state has a coherence? Because education does play a huge role in defining state identity and what the state is, but also in that way limits creativity for good or bad. Creativity.
And I was just making the point that I think that in the production of certain kinds of commodities, we're willing to sacrifice some degree of quality or whatever, some characteristics of the commodity itself, for an increased social benefit in the actual way it's produced, right? But I don't think that that's the case. In fact, I think the opposite is the case in the case of things like education. So it's not a question about whether or not it should be standardized nationally or not. I mean, that's also an issue, I guess, but I don't think that's the point that
I think we're conflating several issues, and it's getting a little complicated. Part of what we're doing is trying to evaluate the efficacy and desirability of one of these alternative systems for allocating goods and services, either through the family or the social economy, versus capitalist markets. But we're doing that in the case of schools, in the case of a public good, which is not provided by the market, and so that these comparisons are difficult to make. On the other hand, we're also evaluating them on several criteria at once. We're talking about whether or not the differentiation of quality that capitalist markets provide undermine, on the one hand, our sense of egalitarianism that we want in a real utopia, and on the other, whether or not there's something inherent in that differentiation of quality that hurts people, right? And I don't know to what degree we can differentiate these problems, but it seems like we're talking about several things at once. I wanted to try to interject to clarify.
Yeah, no.
So I was specifically referring to thinking about whether the state provides something through the state providing education or through being provided through co-ops, which would result in different local manifestations of what the education system would end up as.
But the social economy has, what was it, recombinant centralization?
Right.
Wow.
recombinant decentralization. It's recombined decentralization.
So the social economy, in the case of the co-ops, has a strong sense of constraints on what is and isn't possible, but is still provisioned in a co-op system, right? You can produce a balance of local idiosyncrasy and common standards through a co-op system.
Yeah, and go on, Catherine.
But if you're essentially arguing it's the extremes in either case that define the nature of the system, then it becomes really hard to distinguish the extreme of one and the extreme of the other. Will it really begin to sort of resemble themselves? Do you know what I mean? Like, because we're trying to think of the difference between what the state-run educational system looks like.
and what a social economy run educational system looks like, which I think there are big differences in how they would appear. But if you end up with a state-run system which has really active teacher boards, I mean teacher-parent boards, and a social economy system which is really strongly regulated by the state, you do begin to lose that boundary.
Yeah, but then you're getting into contingencies and you're asking what's the difference between a duck, you know?
But that's
no, but I think this is a very useful point that Catherine's making, and it's at the core of the notion of hybridization that I try to think through in different ways with respect to the logics of different ways of organizing things. So I use the notion of hybrid to describe the nature of the way power gets deployed within economic systems. But this is another form of a similar issue. So we can imagine a pure co-op system of social economy where the role of the state is merely to set the rules in which co-ops are formed and to create enabling conditions for them to be sustained. So the role of the state with respect to a pure social economy is similar to the role of the state with respect to a capitalist economy. The state also has to set up rules for how contracts are formed and how they're enforced and the money supply and all that sort of Toddian sort of thing. He's a money guy. That's the sociology of money is his specialty. So you could have a state that does not play a role interior to the co-ops. It's just setting the parameters. And you could have a state public school system in which the schools are just an agency of the state and they're run like other state bureaucracies with employees who do what they're told. Right, so those, the French system, right, where the French Minister of Education can look at his watch and say it's 10:15, every fifth grader is reading Victor Hugo. You know, he knows exactly what's happening throughout France.
Impeccable handwriting, too.
But then you can say, well, there are some virtues to the co-op system because of its ability to tap impacted knowledge and to figure out how best to educate kids in different cultural contexts and how to make education meaningfully connected to other things that are important in people's lives. I mean, all these sorts of things. But we do want to have some commonality of experience among kids, and we don't want an anything-go system. So you begin to regulate the co-ops and put constraints on how they operate, which then makes it more of a hybrid between a statist system and a social economy system. If you did that to the point where at 5 o'clock in the afternoon you'd know that every school co-op was reading Victor Hugo, then in effect the co-op, the social economy feature of it would have just vanished. It would have been hybridized away and just absorbed into the state. Similarly, if you have a regular old state system, but you start having parent-teacher councils, and the parent-teacher councils begin to be able to forge curricular priorities, and the minimum number of core courses and curricular elements that are imposed drops to some very bare minimum, well, then ordinary schools become more like co-ops, mm-hmm. too. You know, so I think it is fine to see it that way. And indeed, the optimal way of providing schooling might be precisely a hybrid between a statist form and a social economy form. That's the way for that particular service to be provided. Whereas for daycare, it might be much more a purely social economy where you just provide the subsidies to make it possible. And for healthcare, you may want your parts of the healthcare system to be statist, to have the hospitals actually run by the state, not run by co-ops of surgeons and nurses or whatever.
I don't know if you talked about this. In Argentina, there was a debate about decentralization of education, and there was an argument against it, which I agree, and I don't know if it can relate it to this, because schools are mostly based on neighborhoods. And since you have such an unequal society where you have poor neighborhoods and rich neighborhoods, the centralization would have ended up in having great schools and bad schools. Like, you already have them with state system, so that would be worse in that kind of system. And also the unions were opposed, teachers' union, because, I mean, that would have weakened the union, as you said. So those two problems were posed in the Argentinian debate, and finally the education was decentralized to the states, but not to this charter model that they wanted to import. So it was like a midway, and actually weakened the union, because there was no national strong union anymore.
But they rejected the charter system because
of this. One of the reasons I remember is that this, like, the neighbor, I mean, the schools were in poor neighborhoods or rich neighborhoods, and that would be worse than it really is now.
To echo that, I think there's, with daycare and education, there's a particular issue, and that's these are children. So children don't have this type of control, and we always can't depend on the parent as being somebody who will be involved in the co-op and be, you know, like, I tutored in Detroit, and, you know, you have a lot of single mothers who can't participate in the school board. You have children complaining that there's not toilet paper in the bathrooms. So you look at that, and you can't say that charter schools or these co-op schools is going to solve some of the very fundamental problems that are going on in education in this country. So I think the argument for the kind of the status and at least a fundamental regulation of schools is really important, especially for the reasons you brought up, because it's based on property taxes and stuff.
But decentralizing funding is different from decentralizing schools. So you could have a perfectly egalitarian logic would say, we want to have centralized funding in which the amount of money given per pupil is inversely related to the per capita income of the neighbor of the school, so that poor schools get more money and have smaller class sizes and have more resources because they have to compensate for the private advantages that or disadvantages that those kids have. So you have more money, so they would have toilet paper in the bathroom. But you could still argue that having community control over those schools with lots of parent involvement, and with the ability of kids to leave a school that they don't like. Mm-hmm. You know, so what the idea of a voucher and charter system, well, the voucher part of the system is that it gives an exit option to kids. They can, because the resources they have follow the kid rather than go to the school. You could imagine, I'm not advocating this because I do think it's complicated, but it could certainly be egalitarian, and it could avoid the problem that schools in poor neighborhoods are poor schools if they're decentralized. As long as the funding isn't decentralized to the resources of the local area.
But the way you... Go ahead, Molly.
I was going to say that would be assuming parental involvement, and if you're looking at, like, poor areas, I think that... I don't know. It gets back to the bigger question of, like, that these systems can work given other circumstances, but because we live in the society that we live in, like, the circumstances that we are placed under make a system, like, a potentially great education system not work because, you know, poor parents have to work, you know, however many hours a week and can't go to, and can't be involved because they just don't have the time to be involved. But I don't know. So it's like, it gets right back to that, like...
So this is there's some very good issues in play here for which I think probably there's no answer. Clear empirical answers. So one is, it's possible that a social economy-based public school system organized through vouchers and association-based schools, so let's call them charters because that's the language that's been used, could be great under egalitarian background conditions and disastrous under inegalitarian background conditions. So it's a real utopian model contingent upon the presence of other real utopian features. So that's one possibility. Another is, however, that we know that an ordinary public school system also does badly under inegalitarian background conditions. That the lack of involvement of parents in those kinds of schools is also bad for kids. It's possible that a more freewheeling community-based school system, if properly funded, know, so we're still having more funding per student in poor schools than in rich schools. So we're having the egalitarian funding that the greater local autonomy and flexibility with proper funding could actually make those better because it would make it much more possible, given small class sizes and greater teacher control, to rope in at least some of the poor parents into developing and running, organizing school affairs, which will then plug that school much more deeply into the neighborhood. It would play a much more constructive, positive role. But only if the funding structures remain centralized and egalitarian, that is, having more funds go to the poor schools. It's just not clear how this would play out. We've been going at it now for almost an hour and a half. We started late, of course. I suggest we do take our break and then come back to the asset, equal asset market socialism for a while, and then close off with the big questions of of the role of markets in a socially empowered economic structure. Okay?